It's the first time that Imran Khan and President Trump have met, and Afghanistan at the top of the agenda.
Pakistan's Prime Minister visits the White House. It's Tuesday, July 23rd. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We're glad to have you with us. You'll find us as well on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, new details emerge from a deadly Japanese fire. India aims for the moon. The push to renew energy, wood construction, and urban heat islands. It's all on today's VOA Asia. The United States and Pakistan are jointly seeking a way to end the war in Afghanistan. That led to the meeting of U.S. President Donald Trump and Pakistani Prime Minister Imran Khan in the Oval Office Monday. VOA Asia's Ira Melman spoke with Steve Herman at the White House about the meeting.
Well, this is a highly significant meeting. It's the first time that Imran Khan and President Trump have met, and Afghanistan at the top of the agenda, obviously. And I won't say that there have been any big surprises out of it, but there did appear to be good chemistry between these two leaders meeting for the first time, and a commitment and words to that effect to work together on getting an agreement signed with the Taliban while the United States continues to reduce the number of its troops in Afghanistan. So in that sense, it was quite positive.
Well, it wasn't all positive as far as how Donald Trump has looked at Pakistan over the past year or ever since he's been in office, blaming them to a large part for supporting terrorist organizations.
Right. And he said that all that's changed with Imran Khan coming into office, acknowledging that until then that Pakistan wasn't doing anything for the United States. And he used the word subversive and said that Pakistan was going against us. That had led to the suspension of military training programs with Pakistan and canceling hundreds of millions of dollars in security assistance to the country when the president had accused Islamabad of offering nothing but lies and deceit while giving safe haven to terrorists.
So what has changed?
Well, the personalities have changed, and Khan really sought this meeting. Like President Trump, he's someone who used his celebrity background, in this case Khan being a cricket star in the past, and his wealth and his populist message to come to power. So although Pakistan and the United States haven't been in sync, and under the Trump administration, there's been a continuation of leaning more closely towards India. The fact that these two have somewhat similar backgrounds in how they came to power, and with Trump, the personal relationship is very important. So Khan may be able to take advantage of that.
Donald Trump did make some comments about being able and knowing how to end the Afghanistan war very quickly.
Yes, this was, I think, the most eyebrow-raising part of the 40 minutes or so when the pool reporters were in the Oval Office. The president said that, quote, "I could win it in a week. I just don't want to kill 10 million people," talking about the war in Afghanistan. But he said to do that, Afghanistan, quote, "would be wiped off the face of the earth. It would be gone. It would be over literally in 10 days. I don't want to go that route." Now, that immediately caused some alarm. There are some, including a highly decorated former commander of the U.S. Southern Command, the retired General Barry McCaffrey, who took to Twitter saying that Trump was considering using nuclear weapons to kill millions of people in Afghanistan as a solution to the conflict. However, that is probably not what the president was alluding to. Later on, during that session in the Oval Office, a Pakistani reporter asked a question, and Trump mentioned having rejected an increased production of a large bomb which had been used in Afghanistan. Well, obviously, nuclear weapons haven't been used there, but that was apparently a reference to the non-nuclear MOAB, the Massive Ordnance Air Blast, or the mother of all bombs, as it's known, which is probably the largest non-nuclear bomb out there, equivalent to yield of explosives in the range of about 11 tons of TNT.
There were a few other things that were discussed. Anything of great headline importance?
Well, I think, again, in these sort of encounters, it's very important to watch the body language, see how the president was responding. Trump was very generous with his time, calling on a lot of Pakistani reporters. And it was obvious that the president did want some exposure. And there were follow-up meetings, of which we may get some details later on, that were going to involve high-level military and intelligence officials from both the United States and Pakistan. And that's where they would really get down to the nitty-gritty in all of this. This could be a significant improvement in a relationship that's reversed between Islamabad and Washington, or it could just be a one-off and we're back to more of the same tension very soon.
VOA White House correspondent Steve Herman speaking with VOA Asia's Ira Melman. These are among some of the top Asia stories that you'll find right now when you visit our website, voanews.com. Hong Kong anger grows after attack on protesters. China lashes out at Hong Kong protest targeting its office. Internet cutoff in Myanmar's Rakhine enters fifth week. A report says China's Huawei helped develop North Korean wireless network. Why China and Vietnam can't stop clashing with each other. You'll find expanded coverage of all these stories, details, photos, videos, and much more at Facebook and VOA Asia and on our website, voanews.com. VOA Asia continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Japanese media reports smoke spread so quickly through a burning Japanese animation company last week that a majority of victims who had tried to flee through a rooftop door were not able to open it before perishing. Reuters correspondent Grace Lee reports.
Grisly new details have emerged from Japan's deadly arson attack. According to local media, many of the victims fleeing the flames were overcome by smoke as they tried to escape through a rooftop door. 34 people were killed in the attack at Kyoto Animation last Thursday. The attackers shouted the word "die" before pouring gasoline at the entrance and lighting the building on fire. 19 of the victims were found piled on top of each other on a stairway between the third floor and a door to the roof. Early reports suggested the door couldn't be opened from the inside. But according to NHK on Monday, police say the door could be opened, but smoke had spread so fast that victims were overcome before they had a chance. According to an autopsy report also released on Monday, 20 people burned to death, 3 died of carbon monoxide poisoning, and 2 suffocated. The cause of death for one person is still undetermined. Police have issued a warrant for suspect Shinji Aoba, who's in hospital with serious burns. They plan to arrest him once he recovers.
Reuters correspondent Grace Lee. In New Zealand, official police figures show residents have handed over more than 10,000 guns, weapons, parts, and accessories in the first week of a buyback plan prompted by the country's worst peacetime mass shooting. VOA's Luis Ramirez has more.
A gun reform law passed in April banned most semi-automatic firearms, parts that convert firearms into semi-automatics, magazines over a certain capacity, and some shotguns. Owners have until December 20th to hand in their weapons, and the government has set aside over $140 million to compensate them for up to 95% of the original cost. The buyback comes 4 months after a lone gunman with semi-automatic weapons attacked Muslims attending Friday prayers in Christchurch on New Zealand's South Island, killing 51 people. A police spokesman told Reuters that more than 2,000 people have surrendered more than 11,000 firearms, parts, and accessories, and in return, authorities have paid them slightly more than $4 million since the buyback began last Saturday. Brenton Tarrant is accused of the March 15th killings. He is due to stand trial in May and has pleaded not guilty to 92 charges over the attacks, including New Zealand's first terrorism charge. With a population of just under 5 million and an estimated total of 1.5 million firearms, New Zealand ranks 17th in the world in terms of civilian firearm ownership, according to a small arms survey. Luis Ramirez, VOA News.
Happening now in Asia, Yukio Amano has died at age 72. The Japanese diplomat led the International Atomic Energy Agency for a decade and was extensively involved in negotiations over Iran's nuclear program, as well as the cleanup of the 2011 Fukushima nuclear disaster. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're glad to have you with us today on VOA Asia. China has reacted with anger after a group of anti-government protesters in Hong Kong defaced the Chinese national emblem on Beijing's liaison office during a massive demonstration Sunday. A Chinese foreign ministry spokesman said Monday actions by some radical demonstrators have affected the bottom line of the One Country, Two Systems principle, referring to Hong Kong's special status under the terms of its 1997 handover from Britain to China. Hong Kong riot police fired tear gas and rubber bullets to disperse protesters. The latest chaos followed a familiar pattern over the last several weeks, starting with a huge peaceful protest that evolved into a night of clashes between police and more hardcore groups. Hours later of the latest encounter, a group of white-clad assailants were caught on cell phone video attacking commuters in a Hong Kong subway station. Eyewitnesses said they appeared to target black-shirted passengers who had been at the anti-government march. The protests have morphed from a call for an end to the now-suspended bill to extradite Hong Kong residents charged with criminal offenses to China for trial into demonstrations for democratic reforms and an end to Beijing's tighter grip on the territory.
5, 4, 3, 2.
India has successfully launched an ambitious mission to land a rover on an unexplored area of the moon as a rocket hurtled into space from eastern India. The project aims to make a soft landing on the moon, a feat accomplished by only three countries so far, the United States, Russia, and China. The launch Monday came a week after the high-profile lunar mission was abruptly aborted last week after less than an hour before takeoff due to a technical snag. After a live telecast showed the Chandrayaan-2 taking off, onlookers cheered, scientists clapped and hugged in the control room. Kay Sivan is the head of the Indian Space Research Organization.
Today is a historical day for space and science and technology in India. I am extremely happy to announce that GSLV Mark III vehicle successfully injected Chandrayaan-2 in the defined orbit. In fact, the orbit is 6,000 kilometers more than what our internet is better.
Chandrayaan-2 is India's second mission to the moon. The first one in 2008 did not involve a robotic probe to the lunar surface. And it comes at a time when the Earth's nearest cosmic neighbor again emerges as the focus of exploration by spacefaring countries, and days after the 50th anniversary of the first manned lunar landing. India is hoping to become the first country to conduct the on-ground studies of the moon's south pole. India's first moon mission helped confirm the presence of water on the lunar surface, and in 2014, India conducted a successful orbital mission to Mars. Coming up, renewing energy. You're listening to VOA Asia.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA programs. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
The This news from VOA Asia, a sweeping internet shutdown in Myanmar's conflict-hit Rakhine State, has entered its fifth week as residents called on the government to end an information blackout that rights groups say could provide cover for rights abuses. Authorities say the internet was being used to coordinate operations. Visit VOA Asia Facebook each day for more top stories and great features. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, the federal government is retreating from dealing with climate change, but major parts of corporate America are moving forward anyway. Some of the largest companies in the United States are pushing for renewable energy, when even local authorities are not, as we hear from VOA's Steve Barragona.
These are the brains of the internet, housed in vast warehouses of computers called data centers. Every click, tap, and swipe runs through a data center somewhere.
And you're sitting right now in Northern Virginia. You're right in the center of the largest data center market in the world.
Stan Blackwell is head of economic development at Dominion Energy, the region's electric power company. Northern Virginia is home to more data centers than anywhere else in the world. And Blackwell says each data center draws about 30,000 kilowatts of power.
So to put that in perspective, an average residential home is 4 kilowatts.
These power-hungry buildings belong to some of the biggest names in tech: Facebook, Microsoft, Google. These companies have plans to get all their power from renewable sources. Brian Janis is Microsoft's energy manager.
It's important that what we build leaves a positive legacy, that we don't build it on the back of fossil fuels, but rather we build it on the back of the next generation of energy technology, of wind and hydro and solar.
And companies are willing to push hard to get it. Facebook helped modify state regulations so Dominion could sell the company power from several solar farms and build several more.
Facebook drove that change in that new tariff, and we're very happy with it. It's great for our customers.
Many companies have been willing to pay a premium for renewable energy. Now, in many cases, they no longer have to, as the cost of wind and solar has plunged in recent years. So when Dominion Energy submitted plans to build more gas-fired power plants to meet demand growth, Microsoft, Amazon, Apple, and seven other companies wrote to regulators saying, no, we want renewables.
We just don't really see why utilities should be talking about building new fossil fuel plants that realistically may only have a useful life of a few years before their costs are significantly undercut by wind and solar paired with storage.
Blackwell says Dominion prefers a mix of energy sources for reliability, but that may change.
Theoretically, if you had very cost-effective battery technology and a lot of solar, perhaps that would displace natural gas. It's not there today.
From autos to retail, major companies across the country are demanding that local authorities supply renewables, or they'll build their facilities elsewhere. Alabama's Public Service Commissioner Jeremy Oden saw that firsthand.
Our first solar decision in the state of Alabama was based solely on the Walmart decision to come in and use solar power in the state of Alabama.
When governments are not making climate change a priority, sometimes the private sector is taking the lead. Steve Barragona, VOA News.
This news break from VOA Asia, the Washington Post says Huawei Technologies, China's giant tech firm enmeshed in Beijing's trade dispute with the United States, secretly helped North Korea develop a commercial wireless network in recent years. The newspaper says Huawei partnered on several North Korean projects for at least 8 years. Your personal news partner is VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, tall buildings made of wood are beginning to pop up all over the world, from the United States and Canada to Norway and soon England. Builders say wood may well be the preferred construction material of the future. VOA's Kevin Enix constructs the story.
If and when this building in London called Oakwood Timber Tower 1 is completed, it will be the tallest man-made wooden structure in the world. Currently, that record is held by this 18-story building in Norway.
Wooden skyscrapers are a natural answer to climate change. Wood actually locks carbon dioxide when it's being made, while concrete construction, which is normally used for skyscrapers, emits CO2.
These ply scrapers, as they're called, are just as strong and just as safe as steel and concrete, say experts.
In here, what you see is a big block of wood made out of glued individual pieces, individual strips of timber. any one of these timber strips could be a slightly weaker or a slightly stronger. By combining many of them, we generate something of known properties, something of properties which are always the same.
Properties that make it stronger than concrete and easier to work with. Also, one four-story wooden building saves the world a year's worth of emissions from 500 cars, according to U.S. government estimates. That's because concrete emits carbon during its lifetime. Wood absorbs carbon as it grows.
Well, I say to them that it can sound crazy, but actually, if we want to the cities to develop sustainably, we should start to change the way we think. And things that might sound crazy now are actually the sustainable answer to our current problems that we have with climate change.
The Oakwood Tower is a conceptual design, but if and when it gets built, it would be nearly 300 meters tall. Kevin Enix, VOA News.
Has it been hot where you are? It certainly has been here in Washington in recent days. And if you're in a city, you know summer is hot. How hot? A team at the University of Georgia is developing a way to map how hot it is in so-called urban heat islands, down to the level of individual street blocks. Faith Lapidus reports.
On this hot afternoon, remote sensing scientist Deepak Mishra and his team are at the University of Georgia campus transit bus yard, installing a temperature sensor on the front of a bus.
We are able to do this research because of the revolution in sensing technologies, the explosion in data science research.
At the peak of summer, about 30 buses will be similarly wired up.
We're collecting temperature data from these buses every 5 seconds as they go around the campus, go around the town.
Volunteers, mostly students, are pitching in too, with wearable sensors strapped to their backpacks and belts.
And then we start seeing how these temperatures are changing across town, which areas are consistently showing high temperatures, and what happens in the evening time, what happens in the night time.
32 is about 90 Fahrenheit.
With support from the National Science Foundation, the University of Georgia team is compiling highly detailed, fine-resolution maps showing what's called the urban heat island in their town of Athens, Georgia.
Heat is the leading weather killer. It kills more people every year than tornadoes, hurricanes, floods.
Scientists have known about the urban heat island effect for decades, making maps from satellite data. Heat islands are urban areas that are hotter than their less developed surroundings, mostly because they're largely devoid of trees. Dark surfaces like roads and rooftops absorb heat and radiate it back out. Some parts of a city can be as much as 15 degrees hotter than others.
This project is going beyond that to see what is happening within the urban heat island.
Geographer Andrew Grunstein studies how weather and climate affect human health. He says hyperlocal heat maps could save lives by pinpointing pockets of extreme heat.
Heat stroke is the most serious heat thing. Your organs can shut down. It can be life-threatening. So we really want to prevent people from getting to that point.
Especially at risk are the elderly, children, athletes, people with chronic medical conditions like diabetes, and those who do physical labor outside.
People that, say, can't afford air conditioning or don't have air conditioning can be at risk. Some research shows that poor communities are often in hotter parts of cities because they don't have as much green space.
This project in Athens is a small-scale experiment, but Mishra expects that these heat maps will be commonplace in the future. City planners will use them to decide where to plant trees. Communities can use them to make sure people at risk have access to water and air-conditioned spaces.
I see a day when people have this app in their phone, and then the phone tells them, take this route, you'll be less exposed to urban heat.
Using data to drive better decision-making when the heat is on. Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. You'll find us on the radio, many great radio stations around Asia, like the voice of Chungrung, Star Radio FM 88.3. At Chungrung Christian University in Tainan, Taiwan, we say hello to everyone who's tuned in today. Thanks for listening. We also like to thank our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Nelson Lopes, managing editor, Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team, Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, Keith Lane, and Anna Cook. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a wonderful day.